That was Nova M host Mike Malloy reading a letter from a listener who believes the question of controlled demolition of the World Trade Center towers is one of the most compelling areas of investigation. Retired McMaster's University professor Graham McQueen has focused on this area through examining contemporaneous witness statements and the pictorial record. The talk you're about to hear has received much praise for making the topic understandable, sidestepping the mystification created around expertise, the "you're not an engineer, so shut up and sit down" obstacle. This talk is his forensic analysis of 9/11, given May 25th at the University of Waterloo, Ontario. The sound is a little muddy, but I hope you'll be able to understand.
Dr. Graham McQueen has his BA and MA from McMaster University and a PhD from Harvard in Asian religion, and he teaches courses on Buddhism, among other things, at McMaster, or has. He's a professor retired of religious studies at MAC, and founding director of McMaster Center for Peace Studies. He's the director of various peace-building projects in war zones. He's a member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, and well-known for his investigation of the 9/11 testimony of members of the New York Fire Department. His paper addresses the reasons why skepticism is in order, considering the official explanation of the collapse of the Twin Towers, and I'd like to call on Dr. Graham McQueen.
And now on with the show. I have two modest aims tonight. First, I want to explain to you why a reasonable person might have serious doubts about the official explanation for why the two World Trade Center towers came down the way they did. Secondly, I would like to explain why a reasonable person might want to explore a different hypothesis more fully, namely the hypothesis that they were brought down through controlled demolition. So my focus will be quite narrow. I'll be looking at the Twin Towers, variety of kinds of evidence, and especially focusing on the North Tower. These are the Twin Towers, completed in 1970, the tallest buildings in the world at that time, enormous structures, strong structures, over a quarter of a mile high. The tower on your left is the North Tower, which I'll mainly be looking at, also called World Trade Center 1, and you can tell it by the big transmission tower on top. And there they stood until September 11th, 2001. The next few still photographs were taken from an apartment building across the Hudson River. Both towers have been struck at this point. And you see again the North Tower on the left, South Tower on the right. North Tower was struck about 8:47 a.m., South Tower about 15 minutes later. The only thing I want to note at this point is that they were struck quite differently, a point to which I may return briefly later. North Tower struck very high and wham in the middle of the north face between the 92nd and 98th floors. South Tower was struck in the south face and actually went through the southeast corner of the building, much lower, between floor 78 and roughly floor 85. So they're struck differently, different kinds of damage. This was a great tragedy and obviously a great crime, since somebody or other clearly intended to do this. Firefighters arrived to find human body parts strewn all over the streets. It was a horrific sight. As they stayed, they watched people jumping from the very top of the towers. They were quite traumatized by all this, by the way, and some had not gotten over it. Nonetheless, they expected that these were very large office fires. that they would burn themselves out, and that their main job was to simply rescue as many people as they could. Imagine their astonishment then, when less than an hour after the South Tower on your right was struck, a very strange thing happened to it. That's what happened to it. Now, if you didn't know anything about this event and somebody showed you that photograph, I wonder what verb you would use to describe what's happening to that tower. I doubt that many of you would say, it's falling. That's a falling building. I certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't even use the verb to collapse. I don't know what I'd say. Maybe I'd say, it looks like it's being violently pulverized. Maybe I'd just say, it looks like it's being blown to bits. But I sure as heck wouldn't say, that's a falling building. That building flowed to the ground over a period of seconds and rushed through the streets of Manhattan in all directions. We were left with the North Tower standing, apparently with a very large office fire. As Key has pointed out, the jet fuel had burned off ages before this. This is office furniture burning at this point. Imagine everyone's surprise when another half hour later, the same thing happens to the North Tower. And it flows to the ground and rushes through the streets of Manhattan. As we look at still photographs, and by the way, I'm not trying to give you anything that's rocket science at this point. You don't need a PhD to look at these photographs. I'm trying to actually talk informally at this point, just asking you to open your eyes, because much of this is not rocket science. Much of this is a rather obvious fraud, in my view. As we look at the still photographs of this event, we notice not only the extraordinary energy being released during these so-called collapses, but the symmetry, the distinct plumes of pulverized debris being thrown off by the buildings. The fact that these buildings essentially were peeled off, they changed state, so to speak, as they came down. They weren't buildings anymore when they hit the ground. So we have a right to ask, what's your explanation for this? I mean, for example, if I ask a friend, I have lots of friends who are engineers, structural engineer, is that what a steel frame building looks like when it comes down like this? And he said, I don't know. Why don't you know? It's never happened before. It's never happened before? No. Well, what's the closest thing, I say? Oh, controlled demolition. You can bring them down if you have lots of explosives, but it's never come down like this in any other way. So we have a right to ask for an explanation, and there are two main official or semi-official explanations that have been put forward, and I think we should look at them. I'll be concentrating on the second one because it's the one current at the moment. The first one is usually called the pancake hypothesis. It was put forward by a number of academics quite soon after 9/11, but gained public legitimacy and prominence when it was adopted by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency of the United States government, in its 2002 report on the fall of the towers. Even I use that misleading term. And for about 3 years, this was the reigning hypothesis. Essentially, the idea is that the fires caused the floors, meaning the actual floor assemblies, to collapse. And they fell. One fell on another, which fell on another, fell on another, boom, 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 all the way down. It's called pancaking. The pancaking floors left the columns, the perimeter and the core columns of the building, standing without any vertical stabilizers, and therefore the columns buckled and the whole thing came down. So we are supposed to believe that floors falling down with inside the building manifest themselves visually to the observer like this. There were many problems with that hypothesis, and it was quietly put aside in 2005 and replaced by what some of us call the sledgehammer hypothesis. There are more polite terms for it and more impolite terms for it, but I think this is the best, the most descriptive term. This hypothesis gained prominence when it was adopted by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, another branch of the U.S. government, U.S. state. And I'll be just referring to this as NIST because it's shorter. NIST carried out a large study funded by about $20 million between 2002 and 2005. The 2005 report essentially adopted this hypothesis, which had initially been put forward by Professor Bazant of Northwestern University. Now, there are some differences between Bazant's explanation and NIST's, but for our purposes today, I will put them together because, in my view, they're essentially the same hypothesis. So let's look at it. What is this hypothesis? And we'll look at it informally first and ponder it a bit, and then we'll try to look at it in a slightly more disciplined way. So this is closest thing to an official U.S. government hypothesis as to why these towers fell. So we ought to know what it is. This little graphic or cartoon is taken from one of Dr. Bazant's articles, and I have... The words are my own, but they're based very closely on the words in his article. Stage one is on the far left here, illustrated on the far left. The plane hits. We're gonna picture this as the North Tower, so the plane is hitting between the 92nd and 98th floor. Plane hits and causes damage. Stage two, columns in damaged areas start to buckle. This is a buckling hypothesis. Stage three, the upper rigid block starts to fall. Upper rigid block means that part of the building above the plane damage, which was not damaged, therefore was still strong and rigid, and which is capable of falling now through the buckled, damaged area onto the rest of the building, leading to stage four, which I've called wham. Wham is important. We're going to be returning to that later. Without wham, the whole hypothesis falls apart. It has to hit it hard. That's the sledgehammer part. That's why we call it the sledgehammer hypothesis. Sudden impact. And then five, the progressive collapse of the entire building. So you can see why it's called the sledgehammer hypothesis, right? Now, let's get out of the cartoon and look at a photograph, actually a frame taken from a video, to see what this really means in terms of the North Tower. There's the North Tower shortly before it collapses. This theory says that the top 12 floors, and the plus here means the top 12 stories plus the roof and antenna, fall on the remaining 98 stories and crush them. I'm glad some of you are laughing. Not only do they crush them, but they crush them into fine material at extraordinary speed as follows. Note the symmetry, beautiful symmetry. We notice that there's a tiny bit of the core columns, we call it the spire, that's left standing. You can see it to the right of the big cloud of smoke. But essentially, looking at this, I keep asking myself, what happened to the steel frame of the building? You'd almost think this building, you know, to be honest, I could buy this if the top rigid block was made of steel and the rest of the building was made of fine glass. Then it would make sense to me. I could almost see the shards. But of course it wasn't made of fine glass. The rest of the building was stronger than the upper rigid block. The towers tapered as they went up. The top six floors, or seven floors, that is under the upper rigid block, were damaged by the plane. But from floor 91 down, says NIST, there was no significant damage. The swaying caused by the plane impact was less than a severe hurricane. There was no significant fire damage from 91 down. We had an intact building, and a very strong one, from 91 down. How did this do this to it? No columns? I don't think so. These are the columns in the building as it's going up. On the left, you see the core columns, which are massive steel columns, and there were 47 of them strongly bound to each other with steel beams. In the center of the photo, far from you, you see the perimeter columns, which went all around the outside of the building. Smaller, but built of high-strength steel, the beams bound together vertically and horizontally, and there were 236 of them, altogether 283 columns in this very powerfully built building. What happened? What happened? What happened? How could they all come down in roughly 13 to 20 seconds? If you look at this fall, be wary when someone gives you a simple figure for the collapse of the buildings. They came down in 13 seconds or 11 seconds. The buildings did not fall as a rigid block. They weren't buildings anymore when they came down. They flowed to the ground over a period of seconds. As I timed this, the building reached the ground in roughly 13 to 20 seconds. It flowed to the ground over a period of about 6 to 7 seconds. What happened? Let's go back to the graphic or cartoon. We've talked informally up to this point. I'd like to get a little more formal, a little bit more disciplined, to see if there's something we can do to test this, to me, peculiar hypothesis. I call it peculiar in part because if you look at stage 5 here, the drawing, you'll see that the upper rigid block seems to be quite a doughty little thing. It's crushing the rest of the building while retaining apparently its own rigidity, its own mass. It's doing fine. It's crushing this much more powerful part of the building below it. What's happening? What happened to Newton's third law of motion? So I find this odd, but let's look at something we can test. Stage 5, when? So let me just explain what I want to do here. According to this, the upper rigid block must hit the rest of the building hard. Moreover, it must retain enough rigidity and mass to allow it to continue to hit the building hard. Because according to this hypothesis, it continues to stick with the building all the way down. If it hit it hard once, that does not explain the kind of collapse we have. Well, this is a large wham indeed, so let's look for it. This is a very scientific name for this experiment, looking for wham. My daughter told me not to use this, that wham was the name of an out-of-date rock band, and you would all get confused, but... Okay, so here's what we've got. I've tried to draw these arrows as accurately as possible. This is a video of the North Tower, which I've broken up into a series of frames. We see the upper rigid block of 12 stories. We see the damaged area beneath it where the plane struck. This is a rather dim video frame, so you can't see the plane damage very well. I'll show it to you. Still photo on the right showed both of these are the north face where the plane hit, but the still photograph on the right is much clearer. So the plane damages about 7 stories, and above it is the so-called upper rigid block. So we're going to follow the upper rigid block as it comes down. We're looking for wham. That means we're looking for some sign of impact. Okay? And I've drawn this red arrow to accompany the rigid block so you'll be able to see what's happening. Here it comes. Where's wham? Oh, here it is. Big dust cloud. Debris. That must be it. Wham. Bam. Can you almost hear it? Smash. There it goes. Boy, big dust cloud. See, this is how I assume Dr. Bazin interprets this, because he's obviously looked at this video. This is how I assume NIST interprets it. Top, rigid block, falling, bam, creates dust cloud. Huge sledgehammer. But let's look a little more closely. Let's pick an easily visible point on this upper rigid block, and I chose a point on the antenna for starters. The antenna is firmly bound to the tower through a hat truss. We'll choose the antenna, a point of intersection that we can easily follow, and I'm going to create some yellow footprints for you as this comes down. Every time I push the button represents 1/3 of a second in real time. Does anyone see a problem here? The problem is that the upper rigid block, if it's smashing into the rest of the tower, must decelerate dramatically. In fact, it's accelerating. The time intervals, remember, are equal, but the distance covered is increasingly large. It looks like a fairly smooth acceleration graph. Not perfect on PowerPoint, but I can actually measure it quite closely, and I'll show you what happens when I do. I did this about 2 months ago as my own private experiment. It will be published soon in the Journal of 9/11 Studies, co-authored with Tony Zambotti, who's an engineer from New Jersey. Here's what we do. The camera is stable on its tripod throughout this, so we can measure from the top of the frame to the point of intersection on the antenna. We can measure quite closely in pixels how the antenna behaves through its plunge. We can then translate pixels into feet or whatever other measurement we choose because we have a known distance on the north face of the tower. When we do these quite precise measurements, this is the curve we get. We have time on the x-axis on the bottom, distance traveled in pixels on the y-axis. If we transfer pixels to feet, we find that the antenna is not falling as fast as free fall, but is falling pretty fast and very smoothly. The pink line represents what an object falling freely through a vacuum would be doing during that time period. The dark blue line is the antenna. There is no wham. There is no impact. There is no sledgehammer. There's only one way I know of to escape this dilemma, if you're a defender of the official hypothesis, and that is to say the antenna somehow broke loose, traveled on its own through the tower. And it's quite easy for us to show that that's not the case. We can, in fact, watch the roof of the tower. We can see how it keeps pace pretty well. We measure this accurately. We find that the top of the roof is not falling quite as quickly as the antenna, but it has the same smooth acceleration. In fact, every point on the upper rigid block that we can see, that's visible, is accelerating through this period. There is no wham, there is no impact, there is no sledgehammer effect. Therefore, our initial impression that the top part of the building is smashing into the rest of the tower is wrong. Something else is happening. Something, some other force, is destroying over 100 feet of the tower in 3 seconds and is causing the building to turn into powder. I couldn't resist adding these numbers, numbering the plumes of material, because we keep running into strange symmetries as we study these collapses. I therefore conclude that the upper rigid block either did not hit the rest of the building hard the way it was supposed to do, or it was not rigid. In either case, it could not act the way it was supposed to act and could not have been a threat to the rest of the building. There is no wham. There can be no progressive collapse of the building. This hypothesis fails. Now, where does that leave us? We've left behind the pancake hypothesis. We have seen, through a fairly simple grade school physics kind of experiment, that the current hypothesis fails. Does this mean that for two of the most important building collapses in modern history, because of which hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, since 2003 especially, we have no explanation? We're flummoxed? What kind of a challenge is this to the university, and where are universities in measuring up to this challenge? For the most part, they've ignored all this. For the most part, they've engaged in name-calling for those of us who have been willing to look into it. Come on, let's get with it, let's look into it. Now I want to say for the next few minutes that there is another hypothesis that's been waiting in the wings since 9/11. Politically painful, though it may be, to consider it, we have to. And that's called controlled demolition. Now, as Key Dewdney pointed out, we're not talking about standard controlled demolition here. By controlled demolition, I simply mean planting devices in the buildings prior to 9/11 in order to bring them down in a deliberate, intentional way. The devices in question could be explosives, incendiaries, or both. That's all I mean. Obviously, if it was a controlled demolition, it was a covert operation. So the typical signs of controlled demolition would be disguised to some extent. But if we look closely, as we just did, we took the time to analyze a publicly available piece of video material. If we look closely, we may be able to see the signs of controlled demolition. What does NIST have to say about this hypothesis? It doesn't like it. NIST found no corroborating evidence for alternative hypotheses suggesting that the towers were brought down by controlled demolition using explosives planted prior to blah, blah, blah. The NIST report, when it first came out, the first draft, didn't say anything about controlled demolition. But enough people complained to them that they added two or three lines, of which this is the most important, saying, no, we didn't find any evidence. Altogether, 10,000 pages that NIST produced over those 3 years, three lines. Strictly speaking, this statement may be true that they didn't find any evidence because they clearly didn't look for any. If they had looked, there was plenty of evidence in their possession. Everything I'm presenting to you today was in their possession. Controlled demolition would explain how the towers came down completely, violently, suddenly, symmetrically, quickly, and similarly. And let me just stress for a moment, the last of these. You may say, well, of course they came down similarly. The buildings were virtually identical. The planes were basically the same and were traveling roughly the same speed. Why wouldn't they come down similarly? They were struck differently. That's why I showed you that photo earlier. NIST analyzes in detail how many core columns were severed and damaged in one tower, how many were severed and damaged, how many perimeter columns, where the fires went. They weren't hit the same. What kind of strange construction could these buildings have had that, having been struck differently after roughly similar times, they came down in virtually identical fashion? This is a major anomaly, a major question. Controlled demolition would explain the lack of wham or impact. Of course there was no wham. That part of the building had been just blown apart. There was nothing to smash into. The lack of buckling. This is a buckling hypothesis. It requires an enormous number of buckled columns, both perimeter and core. I have searched hundreds of photos of the collapsed site and find very few buckled columns, especially very few core buckled columns. Where are they? Temperatures over 2,500 degrees Celsius, and I'll give you the reference to that in a moment, way beyond office fires, regardless of whether they have jet fuel, and the pyroclastic flow. That's the building, now turned into a kind of strange gaseous liquid, full of hot gases and pulverized material and ash flowing through the building, through Manhattan. Pyroclastic flow could be explained through the use of massive numbers of explosives. As we build this hypothesis, there are three major kinds of evidence we will use. First is physical evidence. The second is mechanical recordings. And the third, which I hope to spend a few minutes on, is witness testimony. Physical evidence simply means we look at the stuff, whatever stuff we have that remains from the day. That could be steel columns. Of course, we don't have many steel columns because, as many of you know, they were recycled rather quickly in Asia. So much for retaining crucial evidence. There was very little material left for NIST to examine. As I recall, they examined less than 0.5 of 1% of the steel in the frame. But what does remain, you would study. You would study the debris given off in those plumes of material. Some of it landed on people's windowsills. Some people have the presence of mind to gather into plastic bags. We have such material. We have a chain of custody. We know who had it when. We can analyze it. It has been analyzed. Key mentioned that. An example of physical evidence is to look at the debris and see what temperatures appear to be indicated. And if you want to look that up, I suggest again you look in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. All you have to do is Google Journal of 9/11 Studies. It's an open access online journal with many key articles in it. Very recent article by Stephen Jones and other academics on the extremely high temperatures achieved during the destruction of the building, probably 2,500 degrees Celsius, which is way beyond office fires and jet fuel, and which is a strong sign of the presence of either explosives or incendiaries or both. I'm just giving you one example each of these first two kinds of evidence so that I can spend a little more time on the third type. Mechanical recordings, we mean audio recordings, video recordings, still photographs, seismic recordings, any kind of recording. And of course, I've already used such recordings in what I've been doing up to this point. You've seen me use still photographs, you've seen me use video material. It's extremely rich, especially the video material. The NIST report, when it first came out, the first draft, didn't say anything about controlled demolition. But enough people complained to them that they added two or three lines, of which this is the most important, saying, no, we didn't find any evidence. Altogether, 10,000 pages that NIST produced over those 3 years, three lines. Strictly speaking, this statement may be true that they didn't find any evidence because they clearly didn't look for any. If they had looked, there was plenty of evidence in their possession. Everything I'm presenting to you today was in their possession. Controlled demolition would explain how the towers came down completely, violently, suddenly, symmetrically, quickly, and similarly. And let me just stress for a moment, the last of these. You may say, well, of course they came down similarly. The buildings were virtually identical. The planes were basically the same and were traveling roughly the same speed. Why wouldn't they come down similarly? They were struck differently. That's why I showed you that photo earlier. NIST analyzes in detail how many core columns were severed and damaged in one tower, how many were severed and damaged, how many perimeter columns, where the fires went. They weren't hit the same. What kind of strange construction could these buildings have had that, having been struck differently after roughly similar times, they came down in virtually identical fashion? This is a major anomaly, a major question. Controlled demolition would explain the lack of wham or impact. Of course there was no wham. That part of the building had been just blown apart. There was nothing to smash into. The lack of buckling. This is a buckling hypothesis. It requires an enormous number of buckled columns, both perimeter and core. I have searched hundreds of photos of the collapsed site and find very few buckled columns, especially very few core buckled columns. Where are they? Temperatures over 2,500 degrees Celsius, and I'll give you the reference to that in a moment, way beyond office fires, regardless of whether they have jet fuel, and the pyroclastic flow. That's the building, now turned into a kind of strange gaseous liquid, full of hot gases and pulverized material and ash flowing through the building, through Manhattan. Pyroclastic flow could be explained through the use of massive numbers of explosives. As we build this hypothesis, there are three major kinds of evidence we will use. First is physical evidence. The second is mechanical recordings. And the third, which I hope to spend a few minutes on, is witness testimony. Physical evidence simply means we look at the stuff, whatever stuff we have that remains from the day. That could be steel columns. Of course, we don't have many steel columns because, as many of you know, they were recycled rather quickly in Asia. So much for retaining crucial evidence. There was very little material left for NIST to examine. As I recall, they examined less than 0.5 of 1% of the steel in the frame. But what does remain, you would study. You would study the debris given off in those plumes of material. Some of it landed on people's windowsills. Some people had the presence of mind to gather into plastic bags. We have such material. We have a chain of custody. We know who had it when. We can analyze it. Has been analyzed. Key mentioned that. An example of physical evidence is to look at the debris and see what temperatures appear to be indicated. And if you want to look that up, I suggest again you look in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. All you have to do is Google Journal of 9/11 Studies. It's an open access online journal with many key articles in it. Very recent article by Stephen Jones and other academics on the extremely high temperatures achieved during the destruction of the building. Probably 2,500 degrees Celsius, which is way beyond office fires and jet fuel, and which is a strong sign of the presence of either explosives or incendiaries or both. I'm just giving you one example each of these first two kinds of evidence so that I can spend a little more time on the third type. Mechanical recordings, we mean audio recordings, video recordings, still photographs, seismic recordings, any kind of recording. And of course, I've already used such recordings in what I've been doing up to this point. You've seen me use still photographs, you've seen me use video material. It's extremely rich, especially the video material. I thought I'd give one more example, though. In a standard controlled demolition, if you look at it closely, you'll usually see material jetting out to the sides just before the building collapses as positioned explosives go off, often called squibs, these explosives, these devices. And the hot gases and pulverized material are quite visible. So even though this is a covert operation, you might well ask whether such ejections of material can be seen. They can. This is the North Tower. If you know where to look, there are actually four visible. There are two largely spent ones above these, now being engulfed in the collapse. And they're in roughly the same position as these two. One is coming directly at you and then therefore looks round, and the other one is jetting out the side. We find these, we find multiple ejections of this kind before the collapse front in both towers as they're coming down. I thought I'd show you one very brief but rich video clip of the South Tower coming down. As the camera swivels to the South Tower, look just ahead of the collapse front and you will see a rapid ejection of white material. If you're quick enough, you'll actually catch two of them. Useful reminder of the reality of the day. How many of you saw the rapid ejection? Okay, most of you did. If this is something that interests you and you want to study it further, there's a very good article in the same journal by Kevin Ryan, High Velocity Bursts and so on. Succinct, 8 pages, but in my view, it really nails this issue. Excellent article. And that brings us to witness testimony. Anything that is witnessed by human subjects on 9/11 who were there on the site in question. This is mainly what I'm talking about. Obviously, the key thing would be witnesses who claim to have perceived explosions in the towers. If these were controlled demolitions, then even if it was a covert operation, which it would have been, surely some people would have heard or seen or felt explosions. Those are the three main senses we're talking about. Seeing, hearing, and feeling. When people tell you that witness testimony is all about hearing things, booms, that's one third of what it's about. Right? We have different senses corroborating each other, just as we have different witness accounts corroborating each other. Are there witnesses then? That's our question. That's our research question. Are there witnesses that claim to have perceived explosions? Are there sufficient witnesses that would arouse our curiosity to do then a more systematic study? And the answer, of course, is there are. I'm going to show you now a very brief video clip from Sophia's documentary, 9/11 Mysteries. I'd like to thank her for giving me permission to show this clip during this presentation. And we have some copies of her entire film, 9/11 Mysteries, available for anyone who wants one. I think they're free later on. So listen closely.
How do these firefighters describe the collapse of the North Tower?
We started running, floor by floor, it started popping out.
It was like, it was as if they had detonated.
Yeah,
as if they were planning to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
All the way down. I was watching it and running.
And others give similar descriptions.
At 10:30, I tried to leave the building, but as soon as I got outside, I heard a second explosion and another rumble and more smoke and more dust. And then a fire marshal came in and said we had to leave because if there was a third explosion, this building might not last.
Like, it sounded like gunfire, you know, bang, 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 bang. And then all of a sudden, three big explosions.
We started walking down the stairs. We made it to the 8th floor. Big explosion. Flew us back into the 8th floor.
Do you know if it was an explosion or if it was a building collapse?
To me, it sounded like an explosion,
but it was a huge explosion.
Chief Albert Turry told me that he was here after the events that took place this morning. He tried to get his men out as quickly as he could, but he said that there was another explosion which took place. And then an hour after, there was another explosion in one of the towers here. So according to his theory, he thinks that there were actually devices that were planted in the building.
Reports of bombs in the buildings, explosions. A CBS reporter to Dan Rather.
But I was coming toward the World Trade Center looking for CBS crews and asked a firefighter if he saw any. All of a sudden, there was a roll, an explosion, and we could see coming at us a ball of flame stories high.
Okay, now if you were a serious researcher and you watched that, what would you think? Probably you wouldn't leap to say, well, that proves that there was controlled demolition. After all, who are these people? Can I trust them? And, you know, can I harmonize their accounts? But you would surely be intrigued. I hope you wouldn't simply say, oh, it's anecdotal, I'm going back to my desk. Or, oh, this is only soft evidence, it's irrelevant. Certainly if you were a good social scientist or a scholar in the humanities, you would want to look see if you could collect more evidence. Make up your mind whether this is serious or not. You might run out with your microphone and actually try and interview people yourself. Or you might find that there was already material available, that somebody had already done that. And you could study these texts for yourself and make up your own mind. And sort of, that's what I thought a little over 2 years ago when I discovered that there was a very large body of material, very rich, been read by almost nobody. That's because it had been tied up in the courts in New York for several years. New York Fire Commissioner Thomas von Essen ordered that oral histories be collected from the New York firefighters, those who were present on the scene. Roughly 500 members of the New York Fire Department were interviewed in the offices of the New York Fire Department by officers of the FDNY. We know all the names, the times, the details, and on the whole, I'm quite impressed by the quality of the interviews. Very little leading of the witnesses. More or less, okay, John, tell me your story, tell me what happened on 9/11. Generally, people were given the freedom to structure their narratives, their stories, in the way they wished. They weren't asked about explosions, with very few exceptions, but many of them volunteered to talk about explosions. I had been led to this material by an excellent article by David Ray Griffin, which suggested, first of all, he's the one who told me that this material existed, but his article also showed that some of these firefighters did talk about explosions. Now, we're talking about roughly 500 members of the department with over 10,000 pages of testimony. To me, and most of my life I've been a textual scholar, to me this was a gold mine. It's very rarely that you get 10,000 pages of material which almost nobody else has read. And I approached it with great enthusiasm, determined to read it all, to look for lots of things. but primarily for evidence of explosions. Who says they perceived explosions? That's the central question. They had, for the most part, they had to identify themselves as an explosion or blast for me to count it. That was the basic criterion I used. What did I discover? I discovered 178 references to explosions from 118 witnesses. Now, if you want to read the article and find out what my criteria were, and what the results are in more detail, same journal, online, open access, Journal of 9/11 Studies, the article is 118 witnesses. The advantage of this article is that you don't have to spend too much time on my boring prose. You can read my rather long appendix in which I quote all the material. You can read all the 118 firefighters' accounts for yourself. Make up your own mind whether this is worth further study, what it suggests or doesn't suggest. Now, what I would like to do at this point is to simply read a very few of these accounts so you'll get a flavor. There are two main serious objections that have been made to my article and to similar research by people who defend the official story. I should say really there are three responses, but the first one is to simply dismiss it all, to ignore it, which is what the major media do, or to say it's anecdotal, it's soft, we never trust human witnesses, and so on. This, of course, dismisses a large part of what we do in the humanities and social sciences. It's naive. It's actually ridiculous. You don't ignore evidence. You find disciplined ways to approach it. You don't ignore human testimony. Our courts would get nowhere if they did ignore human testimony. So the question is, how do we approach it? The second objection, which is somewhat more serious, is to say, well, there were people who heard loud sounds, so what? Could have been anything. Typically, they'll say it could be elevators crashing, it could be bodies falling, it could be steel columns snapping, any number of things. How do you know they're explosions? Now, the answer to that is complex, and we don't have time for it all, but I thought in lieu of a detailed answer, I'd simply read you a couple of accounts, and you can tell me whether you think they sound like elevators crashing or whatever. The first of these is not from the fire department testimony. We have other bodies of evidence as well. Some is from the Port Authority police. So I have one testimony from a police officer. The rest are all firefighters. I chose the police officers because it's a rich description and because she has high credibility. Her name is Sue Keene. She was a police officer for 8 years before this event and was in the U.S. Army for 13 years before that. I suggest to you that she probably knows an explosion when she perceives one better than most of us. It's a high credibility witness. Here's Sue Keene. It sounded like bombs going off. That's when the explosions happened. I could hear it coming, and I knew something was going to happen. I braced myself. It started to get dark, and then all of a sudden there was this massive explosion. We were on the mezzanine, which is all encased in glass. The windows blew in. Everything went black. We all got thrown. In the military, they blow things up around you so you're not afraid of it. You don't panic. If something blows up, we cover. We breathe into our shirts. We wait for it to pass over. And then we look up before we get up. All that stuff stayed with me. There was this incredible rush of air, and it literally sucked the breath out of my lungs. Everything went out of me with this massive wind. Stuff was just flying past. I had burn marks, not like you'd have from a fire, but my face was all red, my chest was red, and for 3 or 4 days, there was stuff coming out of my body like you wouldn't believe. It was like shrapnel. Okay, I don't think that's snapping steel columns, do you? Elevators crashing? This is a very rich description by a high credibility witness. I'll read you one other of this type. It's shorter. It's by a firefighter, George Kozlowski. We made it around the corner, and that's when the shit hit the fan right then and there. We heard that loud ba-boom. It was like an earthquake or whatever, a giant explosion. Then this big gust came, and I just went flying, maybe 30, 40 feet, tumbling. I got up, got on my hands and knees because all of this white shit was all over me. I just kept crawling, and my ears were like deaf. You know when you hear a giant firecracker or something? Again, bodies falling, elevators crashing? I don't think so. I think anyone who reads the 178 accounts that I collected will conclude that whatever the heck it means, there were explosions, and some of them were massive. But now to the third objection that's raised to this material. Okay, says this objection, there were explosions, big deal. Explosions often accompany large fires. There's all kinds of possible causes. Actually, these objectors usually don't go into the causes, but I've looked into explosions that accompany fire. It could be so-called smoke explosions. It could be so-called boiling liquid expanding vapors explosions when a boiler blows up. There's several other kinds. So this is a more serious objection. This is one we can get our teeth into. This is one that really deserves a proper and lengthy response. It's saying, yes, there were explosions, but that doesn't mean that there was controlled demolition. It doesn't mean these explosions brought the buildings down. Now, there are two main ways I would respond to this, and I'm sorry I don't have time to do it in great detail. The first is to point out that although we have testimony to explosions in the buildings throughout the time period, from when the planes hit until when they come down, it's nonetheless true in the firefighter accounts that by far the majority of the explosions talked about come directly before the collapses of the buildings. It suggests to the firefighters themselves and to the reader that there is a causal connection, that these explosions brought down the buildings, or were at least part of the reason for it. I'm being cautious here because I know causality is hard to prove. But when you read one account after another that says, I heard a massive explosion, I looked up and the building came down. I heard three huge explosions, I looked up and the building was coming down. After a while you come to say, well, it's silly to pretend there's no connection. But if there is a connection, then these could not have been the regular explosions that accompany large fires. None of the explosions that accompany large fires, smoke explosions, BLEVs, or anything else, could bring down a 110-story steel frame skyscraper. So if there is a causal connection, these were explosives. That's the first line of answer. The second line of answer is that there are patterns. There are apparent patterns in these explosions. They do not appear random. They appear human, designed, deliberate, and to the extent that this is true, this suggests, of course, that they were planted and that controlled demolition is at issue. And I'm going to end by reading four of these typical accounts which suggest patterns. Richard Banachisky. We were there, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 minutes, and then I just remember there was just an explosion. It seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings. It seemed like it was going all the way around, like a belt, all these explosions. Okay? There are quite a few accounts of that. Second, Karen DeShore. In fact, Captain Karen DeShore. Some of the people who perceived these were high-ranking people in the FDNY. Here's Karen DeShore. Somewhere around the middle of the World Trade Center, there was this orange and red flash coming out. Initially, it was just one flash. Then this flash just kept popping all the way around the building. And that building had started to explode. Popping sound. With each popping sound, it was initially an orange and then red flash came out of the building. And it would just go all around the building on both sides. As far as I could see, these popping sounds and the explosions were getting bigger, going both up and down and then all around the building. I went inside and told everybody, I think we have another major explosion. And shortly after she says this, the North Tower, which she's referring to, comes to the ground. Daniel Rivera. That's when I kept walking close to the South Tower, and that's when that building collapsed. Now, the questioner intervenes, as they sometimes do at this point, and says, "How did you know that it was coming down?" Rivera answers, "That noise. It was a noise." Questioner, "What did you hear? What did you see?" Answer, "It was a frigging noise." At first I thought it was, do you ever see professional demolition where they set the charges on certain floors and then you hear pop, 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 pop? That's exactly, I thought it was that. When I heard that frigging noise, that's when I saw the building coming down. And I'm going to end with Kenneth Rogers. We were standing there with about five companies, and we were just waiting for our assignment. And then there was an explosion in the South Tower. A lot of guys left at that point. I kept watching. Floor after floor after floor. One floor under another after another. And when it hit about the fifth floor, I figured it was a bomb, because it looked like a synchronized, deliberate kind of thing. What I want to suggest to you is that Kenneth Rogers was probably right. Standing directly in front of the building on 9/11, looking closely at it, watching it, not running away, wanting to catch the process, his instincts and his reason told him this was a synchronized, deliberate kind of thing. And I'm suggesting to you that he was right, and that it was. And this has enormous political implications. I believe that the people that did this were very bold and quite smart, but not as smart as they thought they were. I believe they left their footprints all over this thing, and that many of us are starting to see those. I end with a plea. I hope that you will join us in doing research on this subject so that we can expose the criminals who did this before they carry out another similar action. Thank you.
Graham McQueen, Professor Emeritus of Buddhist and Peace Studies from McMaster University, speaking on May 25th. Thanks to the contributors of 911blogger.com for the material used in the program this week. You can download this and previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Bye.